Today is Wednesday. It's December 15th, 2021. It's 1:41 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record every Wednesday. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Eric Zorn, the holly jolly publisher of the Picayune Sentinel Weekly Newspaper.
Still cruising off that Songs of Good Cheer vibe, Eric?
Yeah, I really am, and I want to thank you again for coming out and being the MC for our video version of the Songs of Good Cheer program. And that video is going to be available. It's available right now for purchase or rental at the Old Town School site, and it'll be starting to stream on Sunday at 3 p.m. And like I say, it stars John Williams and a cast of thousands.
So. Yeah, right. I'm on the stage for 90 seconds. I say something about, you know, Merry Christmas and sharing music, and then you guys come out and just do an amazing show. Have you seen any of the video yet, by the way?
I haven't. No, we haven't seen any of the video, but we had five cameras in the auditorium there, two of them crawling around the stage, and really looking forward to the work. It's we have a really good videographer doing the job for us, so we're really looking forward to seeing what she comes up with.
The crew is amazing. Really, like, super professional. I'm like, holy crap. And we were walking around backstage before the show started, and we didn't start right at the start time. We started a few minutes later, so I'm kind of walking around thinking about what I'm going to say, and then somebody says, hey, you need to get over there. So I walk backstage, and just as I'm like going up the steps to the backstage, the guy before me goes, and here's John Williams. And I went, holy cow. So I still had my notes, and I was kind of a little disheveled. I wasn't TV ready, Eric, is what I'm saying. I'm apologizing in advance if I didn't look focused or looked frazzled.
A frazzled Christmas. So I would encourage everyone to support Songs of Good Cheer. But also, I think Old Town School of Folk Music is doing a fundraiser, because I saw something where you could get, and Eric's background is Old Town School, and in that room, you can get your name on a chair. And it's not that expensive. It's like $2,000, I think. It's not something crazy. You could be immortalized on someone's seat.
Oh, no kidding. Like a little plaque on the back or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
I got to do that. I think Mary Schmeek has a brick in the back patio. You can buy bricks back there too. I don't know what those cost, but
well, I would, but I bought most of the bricks at Wrigley Field, so I'm a little tapped out right now. Have you seen that all over? I wear on Wrigley Field, they've got all of those names, and I'm wondering when the team gets bad or stupid, if people kind of go over there and etch their name out and go, you know, you've got my money, but I don't want my name on the pavement here. Maybe those tornadoes that ripped through Illinois, Kentucky, and three other states this week would have happened were there no climate change. But meteorologists tell us that with global warming will come more violent storms. The record high temperature for this state today in Chicago is 64 degrees, and it is 63 right now at 1:44 in the afternoon. Today, people are talking about the integrity of the warehouses and factories that people work in, and should employees have unlimited access to their phones. And I'm also wondering if Amazon and Mayfield Consumer Products down there in Kentucky were treated fairly in the press this week. Eric, what jumped out at you, besides the obvious tragedy of the loss of life?
The stories from the candle factory were a little disturbing, because we've been hearing that people were told that if they left the factory because they were alarmed about the incoming weather, that they might lose their jobs. And that was very disturbing. The Amazon story, it sounds like there was one part of the warehouse that was much safer than another, and then the people who lost their lives had moved to a different corner of the warehouse, and that the phone issue was not in play, the workers were allowed to have their phones in the warehouse. When I first heard that workers were not allowed to carry their phones in the warehouse, I thought that that's not a good policy for Amazon workers, because they are measured by performance. And so if you're not performing, then you get disciplined. And having your phone with you in case there's any kind of emergency, whether it's a weather emergency, a family health emergency, any other kind of problem where your attention is needed right away, you want to be able to have that lifeline with you at all times. I mean, how many of us here would ever go out without our phones? You know, no one. So I was alarmed about that, but I guess it's not at issue in this particular story, but it's something to keep in mind about when you're looking at policies of companies and for workers going forward about the ability to have that phone with them.
We saw the Amazon warehouse, Amazon spokesperson basically said the 6 deaths in Edwardsville, as Eric said, were not in the designated shelter in place. So I think there will probably be an OSHA investigation. There will be a state investigation on, as to what communication was given to employees. I think it's probably too early to say whose fault it was, if anyone is at fault. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're just horrible tragedies. Another thing that people should watch for is that the Amazon warehouse, the fulfillment center in Matteson, the Amazon fulfillment center there, was designed to withstand winds of at least 110 miles an hour. But that tornado had winds between 130 and 160 miles per hour. So there may be some updated rules coming from the state that say, hey, any fulfillment center of this kind or buildings need to withstand winds of higher speed.
When you see these warehouses anymore, you know, travel up and down I-80, as I often do, and it's just amazing how big these buildings are. And you notice that from the overhead coverage of both Kentucky and Edwardsville, and you thought these things are just massive. I don't know how structurally sound you can make a building that big with that high a roof if you're going to have an F3 tornado. So maybe it's inevitable, and we should not ask every building to be able to withstand that as long as there's sufficient shelter-in-place locations within those buildings. But I'm still interested in the conversation about the phones. An engineer texted or called my show this week. I'm trying to remember how I heard this from one of the guys, but he said he was an engineer and that if people like at an Amazon warehouse are walking around with their phones, looking at their phones, they're more likely to get injured or injure somebody than they are from a tornado. I heard from people that work in hospitals, senior care facilities, and they say, we can't have our phones because we can't be distracted from our jobs. If it were the safety of the employees, you would bet that they would be safer without their phones and that there won't be a killer tornado, especially since there's other ways to notify people of a tornado coming. I'm kind of intrigued by that. And it does remind me of the conversation about what happens in schools. I'm still amazed and flummoxed, and I'm not even a teacher, that students have their phones in schools. I understand the reason why you don't have your phone in a classroom or maybe in a warehouse.
I would be opposed to any one-size-fits-all rule on those sorts of policies because it's totally dependent on the context. And there are all sorts of, and I totally believe that statement, especially in a place like a massive warehouse, that if people are distracted, just like if you're distracted driving, mm-hmm. that's highly dangerous, that if you're driving a massive forklift or transporting tons of equipment and you're looking at a phone, that poses a massive risk to those people around you. Now, maybe there should be some contingency planning in case of an emergency that people can go grab their phones from a locker that they have them in or whatever to be able to text or call loved ones. But I think that totally makes sense that some places would have policies where phones are not allowed. I also think in public schools, and I could be wrong here, that has never prevented me from saying something really forcefully on this podcast, but I believe that there are some free speech issues with withholding students' phones in some public schools. And I could be totally wrong on that, but I do think that there is some legal basis.
Yeah, I challenge this statement. I can't believe that there's a free speech issue.
Where do you get this crap, Austin? That's crazy talk.
Is this from Newsmax? I understand the point about safety. I also think that people are so accustomed these days to being able to reach out to one another in certain situations that maybe there needs to be some sort of a provision for emergency communication. And I don't mean life and death situations, but you know, a child gets left at school or a child needs to go to the doctor, that there's a way to communicate with that employee that doesn't involve them.
Well, how did we do it before 1989? Yeah, there's a way. There's a phone.
We were in hell back then, John. No, you're right. But the expectations are different now. People's expectations are different. Of being able to find one another are different. I think that for a school setting, those kind of things, that if there's a need to reach a child for an emergency, then there ought to be a system to page the teachers or that maybe employees could wear pagers if there's an emergency and they could report in and see, find out what the emergency is. I mean, they're just, the expectation of being able to reach people has been established. And so I think to break that for certain employees, you run some risks with that. So I would think that there could be some compromises in terms of being able to communicate without having a device that people are carrying around that's distracting them.
And I just looked this up. So what I was thinking of was people's use of their phone outside of school and then being punished for what they do on their phone outside of school by the school. So schools can have codes of conduct that say you can't use your phone during school hours. But I don't know if you guys ever been to a show? Dave Chappelle did this a lot, where they take your phone and they put it in one of those neoprene kind of bags before the show.
Right.
Fantastic solution. I feel like that would be really easy to implement.
Which deactivates, the phone becomes inoperable essentially then.
Right. It's like a Faraday cage. Yeah.
I've only heard about that, Austin. Do they give the phone back to you then, or they keep it in safekeeping?
You keep it, I believe, in this little pouch that you can't open.
Ah.
And then when you leave the show, they give you, just like if you're buying a sweater at Target and you need that, they have the special untagger device. That whatever sorcery that is, I believe that's the technology.
They're called Yonder bags.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some sort of way that when you leave, they can take it out for you. I mean, it's one of those technologies that would probably be easy to get around if you wanted to. You could carry two phones. You could carry an MP3 recorder or something like that. But the principle is sound, I think, that you don't want people to be away. It used to be that you'd have to take your phone and put it in a locker in certain places like courthouses. And I think they've realized now that since everybody has their phone and relies on it so heavily, that they just have to have stronger rules about when you can have it out, when you can have it in your hand. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me to be something that you could have in a workplace as well. You could say, okay, you can have your phone in your pocket, but we don't want to see it. And if we do see it, you better be able to justify why it was urgent for you to get your phone out. You're not placing a bet with DraftKings or checking your eBay account or anything like that. So it does seem like certain levels of monitoring and discipline can also take care of that problem, if it is in fact a problem.
It's hard to imagine feeling bad for Amazon as a corporation, but I do think they got the short end of the first reporting stick on this thing, because when it first broke, I'm like, what the hell are those people doing in there with a tornado coming? That sounds so Amazon. You could imagine them, Christmas rush, cracking the whip, saying, you've got to get those boxes out faster. I'm not exactly sure what the environment was in there, but there was a safe house and the people were allowed to have their phones. But in the case of the Kentucky, right, there was a warning. People took shelter. They came out, and then a couple hours later, the second warning comes, and then they didn't take it so seriously. Some of the employees said, I want to go home. They said, that won't be safe, and you'll be fired if you leave the building. You've got to stay at work. There was even the notion that some of the employees were offered overtime, and I don't know if that's because they were, in fact, overtime or if that was some sort of inducement to stay. But you would imagine in both cases, both companies are looking at substantial lawsuits coming their way. The story of the woman in Kentucky who was trapped under a bunch of debris, the chemicals from the wax factory or the candle factory are on her. She's getting chemical burns.
It's hard to know what to do. It's sort of a sins of omission versus commission.
Yeah.
But not making them stay there was in the employee's best interest. And if they had let them leave, I doubt the media coverage is, oh, Amazon let workers leave during a tornado, right? Like, it actually would have been, from a PR perspective, probably smarter to say, okay, everybody for themselves, like, or you know,
run for your lives,
stay if you want. But that's not what they did.
There's be any number of businesses around that did exactly what Austin's talking about, where they said, you can stay here and shelter in the basement, or you can go home to your families, but this is coming. And I don't think that you can attach a lot of blame to a company that does that, because they've warned their employees, they've given them options, and what else can a company do at that point?
I guess in Edwardsville, they don't have basements. The water table is pretty high there, and those warehouses don't have underground locations. So the secure rooms have to be above ground and reinforced, which you can do. I suppose you could build something that would withstand a tornado. But going underground, I was told by a reporter down there, was not an option in Edwardsville. How about this? Armed security guards could begin patrolling Chicago neighborhoods, or at least one, anyway. A neighborhood association in Bucktown wants to contract with a private security firm from Downers Grove, and armed guards, likely off-duty or retired police officers, would patrol an area bound by Northwestern Avenue on the west, Bloomingdale on the south, the north branch of the Chicago River to the east and north. Austin, do you like this idea? The police can't be everywhere. Take matters into your own hands. Hire armed guards.
I think it's really hard to argue against people's right to do that in certain areas of Chicago. There are large crime. I mean, just I live in Lincoln Park. There have been at like 5, 6, 7 p.m., multiple armed robberies of people walking around this neighborhood, minding their own business in the last 2 or 3 weeks. It's happening almost every week now. People who I've never heard express concerns about safety living in Chicago in my 7 years living here are asking me, hey, do you feel safe? You know, I've stopped going out at certain times of day. And I really can't blame businesses for doing this. Now, there needs to be, they should be liable for the conduct of this person. They shouldn't just, you know, be a vigilante, dispensing justice all around the neighborhood just because they're a private security guard. And these things can be controversial. I know University of Chicago, the student body for a long time, the activist members on the left in the student body have for a long time fought to reduce private security in Hyde Park, which University of Chicago hires and oftentimes can be in an armed confrontation with dangerous people, and it results in bad outcomes because maybe their training isn't very good. Maybe they don't know the neighborhood very well. So I think if done well, I have no problem with it. But those businesses and that association should be held accountable for the conduct of these people.
Of course, the problem is, Austin, that if you have, you're talking about accountability, but it's just like a neighborhood association. It doesn't have any assets. And I don't know how you can hold it responsible in any meaningful way if something goes sideways. I think you end up holding the private security firm accountable. And even then, the pockets aren't nearly as deep as they are for a city, for instance.
Oh, I bet they have insurance.
They probably have some insurance. But again, I agree with Austin. I think that this is something where the kinds of crimes that we're seeing, the carjackings, the muggings, and I guess to some extent like the catalytic converter thefts, the ways that people are just feeling like the city, the crime is not under the kind of control in the city that it used to be. And maybe statistically some of these are strange little artifacts, but there is definitely a feeling out there that this is not safe in many places in the city where it used to feel safe. And I think that it's perfectly fine for groups, organizations, block clubs, and so on to hire private security and try to push the problem elsewhere. But that's kind of the problem, is that these neighborhoods that can afford to do this, can afford to pool their resources, are going to end up just pushing the problem into a neighborhood that's not as well off. So that there's sort of a regressive quality to this, where you almost have these quasi-gated communities where security is enhanced, and other places where it's not, and you're going to push crime into those areas. So it's a conundrum, but I definitely see it coming. I mean, I think this is just a pilot project, and if it works at all in Bucktown, you're going to see it in Logan Square, you're going to see it in Old Irving Park, you're going to see it all over the place.
Eric makes a good point about the inequity, and this is the thing that the defund the police crowd doesn't understand, is that wealthy people are always going to have security and police, and they'll pay a lot of money for it. So if you defund the publicly available service, which is the Chicago Police Department, wealthy people are going to do this. They'll have security. They'll have folks who can stop crime. It's low income neighborhoods that will lose protection and have public safety be harmed.
Yeah, you're up in the Lincoln Square area, right, John? And there was just that incident there a week or two ago, where a man's coming out to his minivan and is in the alley and in the morning, and some armed robber gets out and they get into a little dispute and the guy shoots him dead. And this is a neighborhood that's, I mean, Lincoln Square is pretty nice little area.
Yeah, and you guys are telling me that we should not have more security there. I'm sorry if the bad guys go somewhere else where the fishing's easier. Tell the next neighborhood to get their own security guards.
I'm not telling you that at all, John. I'm saying that's going to happen. I think it is inevitable and it's understandable. And if it comes to my neighborhood here in the Northwest Side, I'd probably be on board with it, frankly.
I'm not even sure that defund the police is really defunding the police. It's reallocating funds for the police. Nobody is saying that there won't be police. That idea, defund the police, is as badly named as global warming when it's really climate change. It's reallocating funds. And if there's not enough police, you know, my complaint is that the cops aren't out of their SUVs. They should be walking a beat. I would like to see armed guards, and I don't care if I see their guns. I don't care if they're carrying machine guns like they do in Europe in some places. Show me the weapons. I think I could get more used to that than this notion that I'm just not going to shop because I'm afraid to go to Oak Brook now because they're going to tear up Nordstrom again. The video came out of that today from earlier this month, and it wasn't really violent. It was actually really efficient, but it is terrifying to people.
So what I'm trying to say is this is actually similar to, I think, what the best argument for school choice is, which is that rich people have school choice, and rich people will always have security and police. And for both reasons, it's because they have the money to afford it. And what you should, and that's just the reality. So I feel like when oftentimes folks who are on one side, and I know it's reallocating, but it's not like the Bucktown Association did not hire private social workers. They hired private security. And that's what people want. They want bodies on the street who can stop crime. They don't, of course, we all care about the root causes of crime, and that should be addressed.
Yeah.
But cutting down on all the manpower in the police department because police are inherently bad for a community, the result of that will be private security that is ghettoized in rich areas and lack of security in poor areas. That's my point.
Ghettoized in rich areas. What does ghettoized mean?
Restricted to rich areas, meaning, so ghetto is a poor term, but the private security will happen. Private security will be paid for in rich areas. It's poor areas that have a lot to worry about.
John, you were talking about bad slogans, defund the police. In his column last Sunday, Clarence Page pointed out that Al Smith, when he was running for president on the anti-prohibition ticket, his slogan was vote for Al Smith and make your wet dreams come true. Clarence said it was the worst slogan until defund the police. But yeah, I mean, while we're waiting for police to be reimagined and for the jobs programs and all stuff to come up, there's this immediate problem of muggings and carjackings and smash and grab situations. And we have no problem when a merchants association decides to hire extra security for their stores. So I don't have any problem with people hiring extra security for their neighborhoods, as long as, of course, they're trained and they don't go just shooting at someone who seems to be nosing around the garage. But I think what happens is not that you have these armed confrontations so much, but more like what we were talking about, which is that the people who are out, the malefactors in the neighborhood, are just going to say, you know what, there's like private cops here. Let's move over a few blocks to where those people aren't. There's a map in the paper where these private security officers are going to be. Let's just go somewhere else. And that does become a problem. And, you know, it's a problem that the city is going to have to deal with, you know, writ large. The city's got to handle this problem for the whole city, and not just allow neighborhoods to try to suppress it in their particular communities.
Well, that's the long view. And I think I've been a pretty big advocate of what do we do to stem the tide. But in the meantime, get me some guys with guns and shoulders walking up and down Southport, or if Bucktown wants to do that.
John, this is if it succeeds in Bucktown, which it probably will. It's going to come to Lincoln Square and Old Irving Park and Lincoln Park. It's going to come to all these areas, and the people in the neighborhoods are going to just pool their resources. I don't know what a couple private security guards cost per hour. I'm guessing $40 an hour.
Maybe, but we need more than two. You think about that. How many do you need?
Southport feels like the place that would buy those. You remember when there were Segway cops?
Yeah.
There was like a 5-year period where they were riding Segways. Bart. That feels like that's Paul Blart. Come to Southport. Yeah, Blart. Blart type employee.
Yeah. All right. Why don't you guys tell me about slating? From Rick Pearson's Tribune story this week, top Cook County Democrats began the first 2 days of endorsements. And under this year's endorsements is a pledge county Democrats want anyone they endorse to take. A solemn oath not to back candidates for other offices who aren't slated. So Tom Dart, right, running for re-election as sheriff, cannot personally endorse anyone but Fritz Kagi for county assessor, who is also getting the committee's endorsement. And Dort says he's cool with that. And Tony Preckwinkle, the board president, says that we all need to row in the same directions. She says if you're on a boat, you want everybody rowing the same way. And I'm thinking, yeah, even if the boat's going off a cliff, best we all row together and just sail right off the edge. I mean, I'm offended by this idea. That might sound naive to you guys. I don't think about this stuff that much. But Eric, what's your take on what the Democrats are asking their endorsees to do?
It seems to me that this is something that politicians in a party setting, nominated candidates, endorsed candidates, have done for years. They've all agreed to endorse one another and not have infighting. My understanding of this was that even to be considered to be slated, you had to make a pledge that you would support the ticket no matter what. So if you weren't on it, so say you're somebody who wants to be nominated for sheriff, and you have to sign this pledge in order even to be considered. And then when they don't endorse you, then you can't run. You can't endorse anybody else. You can't run a third party campaign. You can't do anything but endorsing. I mean, if this pledge is legally binding, which I doubt that it is, but there's something that is just really heavy handed about it. And most political parties just kind of understand this is the way it goes, that if you're on a ticket, you support the ticket, but that Tom Dart is not going to support somebody else for county board president or vice versa. And that's just the way it's always been done. And you need not speak it. So the heavy-handedness of it surprises and offends me as well.
It reminds me, definitely reminiscent of daily machine politics era Chicago. And I'm reminded there's a great, I think this is like one of the best book covers ever, period. It's a book called Don't Make No Waves, Don't Back No Losers. And a professor named Milton Rakoff wrote it in the 70s about the daily machine. And it was basically a sociological view of how that worked. And Don't Make No Waves is exactly what this is. We don't want no waves in our party. And it's interesting you mentioned Fritz Kagi, because the person he defeated, Joe Berrios, was one of the most polarizing figures. And Democrats, especially in Chicago, like this is especially concerning because Chicago is essential. Chicago politics is the Democratic Party. It's not like they have meaningful Republican opposition in Cook County. So you're really, really reducing the ability of competent people who want to serve in public office to say something like, in the case of the Fritz Kagi race, hey, Joe Berrios shouldn't be the assessor anymore. I don't think that Democrats should hire their family members to do nothing in the assessor's office. That's just me. Now, if Fritz Kagi becomes Joe Berrios and starts hiring, it becomes the Kagi office and his uncles and aunts and cousins are all working there. No one's going to be allowed to call him out for it. And I think that's bad.
Doesn't this sound at a local level what Republicans do at a national level when they took that pledge, the presidential candidates, to that guy in Iowa? Who am I thinking about there?
Well, they asked all the candidates on the stage to raise their hand and pledge that they would support the ultimate nominee of the party. And as I remember, Trump did not raise his hand. And people expected blowback, but there was no blowback because he just said, you know what? I'm not in this to be part of this party thing. I'm in this for my own agenda, and so I'm not going to make any pledges. And I think people they ended up respecting him for it, for that particular move.
And I may be splitting hairs here, but I do think it's different if you're running for an office in a primary, and someone tells you, "Hey, will you respect the result and you endorse anyone on the stage who wins?" That's a bit different than saying, "Hey, you can't criticize or endorse any Democrat in, for any office in Cook County,
right.
for example. That's right. a much broader thing than simply the office I'm running for.
I'm still thinking of somebody else, though. There was a pledge.
Grover Norquist has a famous pledge, Americans for Tax Reform, that you won't vote for a tax hike. That's been one of the most effective pledges among Republicans for decades.
That may be the one I'm thinking about. By the way, speaking of Republicans, Darren Bailey, the Republican who is running from downstate Illinois, the downstate Xenia, Illinois, white anti-mask farmer, has chosen a black suburban conservative talk show host as his lieutenant governor running mate, Stephanie Trussell of Lyle, Illinois. In her social media posts in 2016, Trussell was opposed to Donald Trump's Republican presidential nomination. She used the hashtag #NeverTrump on her Twitter account. As she wrote, Trump is a despicable human being. She said he will donate to Satan for land deals and that her skin crawls when pundits call Trump the leader of the GOP. He does not represent my values. Trump won the election, and afterwards, Trussell became a big backer of his. She tweeted to fellow Trumpers after his loss in 2020, tell your future generations the truth about the greatest president of our time. She also has used her social media platform to liken Planned Parenthood to the KKK. She's on board with Darren Bailey about not liking masks.
Well, her reversal on Trump is eerily reminiscent of Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz's reversals on Trump.
Yeah.
They said similarly harsh things about him, and then all of a sudden he's the best pal in the whole world. This is politics. It's hypocrisy, whichever you prefer. But yeah, this happened. She is by far not the only Republican to have done a complete about face when Trump had power and has this party under his control. And will this hurt her with the Republican electorate? I don't think so. I think they'll say, well, and they'll look at Ted Cruz, they'll look at Lindsey Graham, they'll look at all the Republicans throughout the country who said
Rubio
about Trump.
Yeah.
Rubio even, yeah, and then just decided that he was the greatest thing ever. So I don't think it's going to hurt. I think Darren Bailey is a ludicrous candidate and a ludicrous person, and I don't think that he stands up much of a chance in Illinois because of some of these extreme things that he has said. But, you know, I sort of gave up doing any political predictions once I so badly blew it on Trump. You know, I thought Trump was a ludicrous person who didn't stand a chance. So it's possible that Bailey could tap into some anti-Pritzker sentiment and thread the needle, win the primary, and then get Ken Griffin's money and give Pritzker a good race. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, by that time, JB will be president anyway, so it's kind of a moot point.
I don't know. So picking her as his running mate, I don't think does much for him. He's not gaining any support that he wouldn't have had otherwise. It was very different with Trump, right? He needed to pick a highly conservative running mate to strengthen him with the base. Darren Bailey has been, he's very, very, very base Trump Republican in Illinois. And I would not count him out of the primary, certainly, especially if another moderate sort of Republican candidate enters and they split the vote with, say, a Jesse Sullivan or with Sullivan or Rabine.
If
Rabine exits and Bailey's there, I think he very much could have a path to win a primary. I agree that it would be really, I can't see him winning a general election, but I would not count him out of the primary.
And it looks like the field is not going to expand. I mean, it looked for a while like there were going to be some who's the congressman from down south who was going to jump. Everyone thought was going to jump
Rodney Davis.
In Rodney Davis was going to jump in, and he decided he's not going to get in. There's been always talk that Ken Griffin himself would jump in the race, or maybe a Ricketts would jump in, someone with a lot of name recognition. But that doesn't seem to be happening. I mean, it's December. It's late in the political season. I mean, it seems like a long way off. The primary is it in June this year?
It's in June. And remember, Youngkin didn't really start his campaign till early summer before the fall election. So there is a lot of time, and I would expect to see it. At least one more person, one more ticket enter the race.
I like your point, though, Austin. It does seem to be a calculated error on his part. If you are that anti-Trump and everybody knows it, or anti-COVID vax and you're super pro-Trump, get somebody that's a little more moderate to get some conservative Republicans in, old school conservative Republicans. You don't gain much with her rhetoric, do you?
No, it's. I think his biggest challenge among the among Republican voters will be he can't beat Pritzker because of how sort of extreme some of his views are. So picking her as a running mate does nothing to allay those fears.
He's not in the model of the kind of Republican that has won statewide traditionally in Illinois, like Jim Edgar, George Ryan, Jim Thompson, and even Bruce Rauner. Those kinds of Republicans are much more socially moderate. Acceptable to suburban voters. I don't think that it was a strange choice on his part to go hard right with a running mate. But again, in the primaries, you don't know. The primary electorate may be very animated by this Trump stuff, and they may pit him against Pritzker. Could be interesting.
You know, speaking of Trump and the Republican Party just a little bit here, Mark Meadows' contempt charges are interesting to me. He was testifying before the January 6th committee. No, pardon me. He didn't testify before the January 6th committee. He provided documents to them, and they called him to testify, and he won't. So now 9-0, right, was the vote to hold him in contempt. That goes before the House. And then the House will have to affirm that and then send it on to the Department of Justice. And then the Department of Justice will have to decide to actually press specific charges against him, whatever those would be. Not as turnkey ready as I'd like it to be. It makes you wonder what the penalty ever is for not testifying before Congress when you're called.
There's some serious issues here about process that have nothing to do with the January 6th. Insurrection, but has to do with will Congress maintain any power to conduct investigations? And if their power of their subpoenas doesn't exist, then they might as well just fold up their tents. If Mark Meadows can say, I'm not going to testify, and there are no consequences.
Yeah.
And this is why I'm surprised. I believe there was a vote in the full Congress on this, and I believe it was, with the exception of Kinzinger and Cheney, It was a straight party line vote. The Democrats all held him in contempt. The Republicans all said no. What are the Republicans going to say when they take control of the House and they want to conduct an investigation and people just flip them the bird when they want to subpoena people? I think this is very dangerous territory for them not to be standing on any principle, but simply to be looking at the politics of it and saying, well, we don't like what they're doing to Trump. We don't like the questions they're asking about Trump. So we're going to block this investigation. If you take that idea, take that principle and expand it, that means that Congress no longer has any authority, no longer has any power to conduct any investigations. So I think this is a bigger issue than just this January 6th commission, but they really have to do this. And I would love to ask some of these Republicans who voted against it, like, what are you thinking long term here? A short term, I see the advantage. Long term, I don't.
Yeah. So the House last night voted to affirm the unanimous vote from the committee.
Thanks.
So
for
now it goes to the Department of Justice.
Yeah,
no problem. And the text messages sent to him that have been to Meadows that have come out have been really damning. I do think it is a little unfortunate that some of this process didn't unfurl as part of the impeachment. If you remember, that went kind of quickly. I think this would have been, I'm glad that it's coming out now, but the impeachment would have been a proper place for this to happen. I'm glad that Congress is asserting its authority. I agree with Eric. I hope that there are some consequences and Congress can actually throw its muscle around instead of always being so deferential.
Walk me through what you would imagine the best use would be of all of those texts that he was receiving. I mean, if he had to testify about all of that, what would they have asked and what does he say? Even Don Jr., all of the Fox News personalities were on Meadows' phone texting him saying, do something about this. Okay, so what?
Did you relay that message to the president? What was the president's response?
No.
I think that's an interesting question. There's also this amazing interaction that came out of this whole process that shows that Pence really was the hero in all this. And I don't want to just throw away that word willy-nilly, but Trump asked him if these people, meaning the advisors that were saying he had the power to stop the election results from being certified, if these people say you had the power, wouldn't you want to? Trump asked, quote, "I wouldn't want any one person to have that authority," Pence said. And Trump asked, "But wouldn't it almost be cool to have that power?" And Pence said, "No." And I don't think that can be, you know, repeated often enough. That's a really, you know, Mike Pence is not Marcus Aurelius, but he was presented with the opportunity to have a lot of political power and said no. And I think he should be commended for that.
Well, the other hero is Dan Quayle, right? Didn't Pence went to Dan Quayle and
yes.
And Quayle stiffened his spine and said, "No, you can't do." Because I guess Pence was wavering, like, "Do I have this power really?" And Quayle said, "No, you don't have that power." So yeah, it is interesting who our heroes have become here.
Do we know who it was that said the National Guard will protect the Trumpers? That was another text that Meadows got, but the one report I read about that one said it was from somebody that wasn't identified. Did that come from the president? Did it go to the president? What's the chain of command on these messages? I want to go back to the Chicago story of Anjanette Young, the woman who was the object of an ill-informed police raid and stood there naked for, I'm not sure how long now, 11 seconds or 45 minutes. Quickly, it sounds like she was given a towel or a blanket or something to put over her, but she was nude in the front. So I don't know that detail matters much, but the city is going to give her $2.9 million. Did they vote on that today, Austin?
They're still in session, I believe, as we speak. But yes, that's expected to be approved by the full council.
And there's a question about there's a lot of questions and details to think about there. One of them is the amount of money. None of it takes it back. But is that a reasonable settlement? When I asked you about that on the radio, I didn't press you on it. It seems so insensitive to say less. And it also seems mercenary to say more. So I don't know how you come up with 2.9. Like if somebody loses their leg in an accident in a factory, there are calculations. You can get an actuarial table and things like that. I don't know how you put a number on this, but at least one alderman said it was not enough. And the corporate council presented to the city council the idea that if she gets $1 million per second, we're out for at least $16 million. So let's settle for about three.
The proper number in abstract is impossible for anyone that I've heard like to assign a number to. You know, it's one thing. There are states that actually have tables that say, if you lose an arm at work, here's how much work comp pays. We've calculated it based on your earning potential, all that stuff. Something like this, how do you assign the correct dollar amount? So in absence of that, and you're the city and your interest is to protect taxpayers, the correct payment is the one that avoids a higher payment if it were to go to court and a judge is going to award them more, right? You want something that's less than that. And perhaps that's the case here. It's hard to prove. What we do deserve, though, is some accounting for what the deal is. And that's the problem with the city law department that reports to the mayor, is that they're making these settlements not necessarily with the interests of taxpayers, but with the mayor's political interests as well. And an example of that is if you had an attorney's office that was purely representing the city's interests, they would want to release the report, the inspector general's report on this incident, so that everybody had in the city had full knowledge of that before or during this, while this payment is being made to Anjanette Young. Right now, the settlement is made, everybody is paid, but we still don't know exactly what the mayor's office did in response to this case. The inspector general described her as being re-victimized by the mayor's office publicly. But we still don't know what's in that report. And to me, that's something everybody should be able to agree on. Maybe some people think the amount to her is too high or too low, but everybody should be able to agree we deserve to know everything about what the mayor's office did in the wake of this.
I'm remembering the Laquan McDonald story, and the city very quickly offered the family $5 million to go away. And that really also had the same stench to it of hush money, hush payments that were done for political purposes. Like, we want this case to go away and disappear. And I believe that part of that settlement was that the family not publicized the video. And
And again, that was clearly done for political reasons, not for, I mean, once your settlement's made, who cares who sees the video, right? Except people who want to see justice done. So I got to be honest, $2.9 million for a period of embarrassment and humiliation seems like a lot when you compare it to some other settlements where people do have lost limbs, have lost their lives, and have not gotten as much money as this. Anjanette Young is alive. Again, I would like to see a sort of a comparison table of like all the different settlements that we've made and what the accusation was, what the suit was, and so on. So to get a sense of, is this in proportion? Are they just afraid that a jury is going to be sympathetic and award $13 million to someone who stood around naked? If you remember, the city's position at first was she had no case at all. They were trying to get the case thrown out for nothing at first. So the city believes that this isn't a particularly significant recoverable case. This amount that they're paying, which is not their money, by the way, it's our money they're paying, seems like a lot to me. And it's one of those things where I feel like I would like to see what a jury really thinks this is worth. Because if I'm on a jury like that, I think, $1 million, that seems fairly generous under the circumstances. You need to punish the department. You need to make a statement. But nearly $3 million seems like a lot to me. I could be talked out of it, but it does seem like a lot to me.
No, I feel the way you do, too. And I can't imagine what that humiliation is like. It must be incalculable. I mean, we've all had those dreams where you're standing naked and then you wake up and think, oh, that was weird and that was awful. Imagine a dozen police officers kicking in your door while you're standing there. It's compounded. Some of my listeners have reminded me. In fact, some Mincing Rascals listeners have emailed me that, why are you guys playing the audio of her screams on the radio? Why do we have to see this on TV? We're just making it worse for her. You can tell the story without that. $3 million does seem like a lot of money to me. I suppose that's all beside the point. Maybe the more important calculus here is, what the hell are these police officers thinking and doing? Did anybody have the authority to say, guys, we need to judge this situation for what it is? She doesn't have to have her hands tied, and we can let her get dressed. We can let her go in the other room and put her clothes on, for crying out loud.
And remember, too, right, the lawyers get a large chunk of that money. And the people who try to wave away police misconduct in Chicago say, well, yeah, we've paid out $500 million in police misconduct over the last 10 years. But, you know, Chicago is a den of vipers full of all of these civil rights attorneys taking advantage of taxpayers because they know they can get these big payouts. And guess what? Maybe Chicago just has way more aggressive civil rights attorneys, or way more of them than other cities. And that's why we're so out of whack. Maybe that's one factor. But another factor is the fact that these cases keep happening, and they're going to keep happening as long as CPD management is poor. And to your point, John, a well-managed team maybe would have some period of self-reflection and say, hey, this doesn't seem like the right thing to do. This is the wrong house. There's a huge checklist of things we need to do first before we raid a house. Basic stuff. And that's the stuff that's got to change if we want to reduce these amount these payouts.
Right, and these settlements. By the way, the settlement was just approved by the city council. I see on my news feed here. But that these settlements are meant to be punitive for the department. I don't think it's necessarily so much to compensate Anjanette Young, but it is to tell the department, to tell the city,
yeah,
you've got to do better essentially with this, and you can't. Allow this to keep going on because it's going to really hurt your taxpayers. Unfortunately, you know, the officers who were part of this raid, and so I don't have any of them even lost their careers over this. I don't know.
No, they were COPA recommended discipline, but none of them have been fired.
And so you've got taxpayers shelling out for, but there's a figure. Is it $85 million a year that the city has set aside just for these kinds of settlements?
Well, Austin,
it's a phenomenal amount.
There's that 538 article that Austin pointed out to me this week. I went and looked at it. You've probably got the numbers memorized. New York is over $1 billion, but we're number two in over the last 10 years settlements paid out.
Yeah, it's almost $500 million over the last 10 years. So, Eric, that would be about in lines, like $50 million a year. But it's getting higher. And this year we're already eclipsed, I think it's $65 million. in payouts for police department settlements. So yeah, it's a substantial chunk of the city budget every year. If this was a product and people were and a company had to be paying all these settlements every year, it would be taken off the shelves. Yeah. Like, there'd be some big changes at the factory. But we're not seeing that quickly enough.
Yeah, think about that. We started this conversation wondering about the safety of warehouses. In the same story that the Tribune had about the Anjanette Young $2.9 million recommendation, which has been approved now, the last paragraph said, by the way, that same attorney also recommended that the city pay $2.2 million in three other cases of police misconduct. I mean, Anjanette Young gets all the headlines, deservedly so, from a news standpoint, but they almost paid the same amount out for three other cases that we never would have paid any attention to. And when we got done with that conversation on the air, Austin, I thought maybe I didn't ask you to make this distinction for us. Not all of the payouts that the city makes are because the police have engaged in misconduct, but maybe a CTA bus hit somebody and so there's a settlement. I mean, if you have that many employees and that much merchandise on the road, and this is inevitable when you do big business like a big city like Chicago, right? So maybe perspective is in order here.
Yeah, but it's by far the biggest, you know, chunk of payouts for misconduct from the city is the police. There's nowhere. CTA is not even close. Any other, you know, streets and sand, they're not in. And you wouldn't expect it to be like they're just not having the same sorts of interactions with the same sorts of people as the police department is. But yeah, it's almost like you would want to see for each of these payouts, we deserve as Chicagoans, what's the after action report? Okay, so Tylenol found cyanide in one of the pills. Where's the 5-page report on what we're going to do differently next time, what we messed up, the timeline, you hold us accountable to this. That should be the case for all of these. And as you said, this is happening like every council meeting almost. There are payments like this that are approved, and they just fly under the radar and keep happening.
I used to have to do that at the Tribune. Reporters have to file a whole – whenever you make a mistake in a story, Tribune reporters have to file this lengthy document explaining how the mistake happened, how you're going to make sure it's not going to happen again. A lot of self-flagellation goes on, and we don't see that sort of introspection in these public-facing reports anyway. And I totally agree with Austin that it's something that we really need to get on.
Well, I'm glad we don't have that in radio or podcasts for that matter. You just say, oh yeah, I got that wrong. Today is the anniversary of the first vaccines given in Chicago for COVID-19. Dr. Arwady at Loretto Hospital and some others.
I thought it was Lightfoot at Loretto. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
It's funny that 1 year later now, as these vaccines rolled out, we're sort of assessing how well the campaign has gone. More people have died of COVID-19 this year than the year before. And one of the scientists said that in terms of logistics and medicine, this is landing on the moon, how quickly this vaccine rolled out. I guess some people didn't believe we landed on the moon either, but it's just too bad they didn't convey the opportunity that this was for us to all get out of COVID land. And here we are now with another strain of it. You know, last week, Heather Sharone, as I was saying things like, it's transmissible, it's highly transmissible, but it doesn't make you real sick. And she said, well, let's not celebrate that too much because the transmissibility of it means a lot of people can get it and it has more opportunity to mutate, and that can be problematic. And I think we're starting to hear reporting like that.
I got to tell you about a conversation we had at dinner the other night. I asked Johanna, I said, do you know what the positivity rate, test positivity rate is in Chicago? She looked up at me and said, who am I, Heather Sharone?
And did you look it up on your phone then? I'm going to guess it's below 5. Test positivity rate has been it used to be so high when this thing was running amok. And now with the vaccine, it is pretty low, right? I'll bet it's 4%.
I think 4.7 was the last I saw, but I mean, that changes all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I believe it's really starting to run rampant these days, and I think Thanksgiving was a super spreader event.
Yeah,
I know it's hit my house and my neighborhood already, and some people in my friend group. And it's one of those things where for a year and a half or more, most of us stayed clear of it, and now it just seems to be everywhere. And unfortunately, the cases haven't been very severe, but this is something that I think it's going to be very, very hard for people to avoid getting.
Positivity rate is 4.3% for Chicago. And I do think the more I read about Omicron, the more I would bet on a theory that this could spread really, really rapidly December and January, but also burn out quickly. That seems to be today, based on what I'm seeing around that variant, and that supports kind of what you were saying too, John. Highly, highly transmissible, and could cause problems, but also would burn out more quickly.
Do you recall that at least at some point in the run of this pandemic, if somebody got COVID, we kind of judged them as being careless or stupid or indifferent. And now when people get COVID, I don't think that way at all. You just think that's the luck of the draw. You might have even been vaccinated. A lot of these athletes in the NFL, in the NBA, and in the NHL have been vaccinated, and they're still getting sick. So
they've been triple vaxxed, most of them, right? They've been boosted.
Yeah, I don't know about the triple, but frankly, I haven't been boosted yet. I got to get that done. I mean, look at me. Look how lax that sounds, right? But I think that's just sort of the fatigue factor. It's just interesting to me, too, how our judginess of people who get COVID-19 has changed a little bit. You know, we're still angry at the people that won't get vaccinated, but we used to get angry at people that got sick. We're like, what the hell are you doing? What did you do?
I think part of the change, too, is at least me, in the back of my mind, I feel like I felt this, and I only recognized it recently, but we often thought once the vaccines are here, we go back to normal. But I know almost everyone I know who has got COVID in the last month or two, and I'm sure you guys too, has been vaccinated, and oftentimes vaccinated and boosted.
Yeah.
And we just have to remember that the point of the vaccine was not to prevent someone from getting COVID necessarily. It's to prevent serious strain on hospitals, which it is doing. And as you said, that is a miracle that that's happened. And many people I know in other countries are still waiting on an ability to get a vaccine or to get boosted.
Yeah. Yeah, the death rates and the hospitalization rates are not spiking the way the case numbers are spiking, as I understand it. So the vaccines are doing their job in that respect.
So Time Magazine's Person of the Year is Elon Musk, and that's a reasonable choice, even if he's not a always popular person. But it does make me think that while they did in the science and technology category or something say the people that came up with the vaccine are the Person of the Year, they're not nearly as interesting as Elon Musk. So Elon Musk is the Person of the Year. The Person of the Year on Earth is not Elon Musk. It's whoever these scientists are. It was a husband and wife team, as I recall, that came up with the first vaccine in Europe. You could just say that whole category, they do that a lot of times. They just say categories of people are the Person of the Year. One year it was you, the content creators on YouTube. They could have just said the vaccine creators or something like that. That would have been, to me, a more correct choice.
Well, I always remind people that the man of the year has been Stalin. It's been the Ayatollah Khomeini. It's been Hitler. It's supposed to be a designation, not an honor. And we get confused about that. And so we think, well, Elon Musk is kind of a sketchy guy in some ways. And the idea is that he has had a greater impact on the news of the world than any other person in the world. Now, I don't know if you can defend that argument so much.
You can't.
He certainly, is there a year when the president of the United States is not the most impactful person? You could make an argument that Donald Trump was the Person of the Year in 2021.
Well, last year they had it was Biden, Joe Biden, and Kamala Harris were the People of the Year last year.
And not because of who they were, I think, but because of who they weren't. I mean, even that was Donald Trump getting a vote.
It's hard to argue that anybody else has had a greater impact on the news of the world in 2021, even than Donald Trump. The way he's controlled the Republican Party, the way he has sort of orchestrated this campaign against our Democratic Republic and this movement toward fascism. Donald Trump, for my money, is the man of the year for Time Magazine. They wouldn't do that because I think people would start throwing Time Magazines out of the doctor's waiting room door. But if you're really looking for the person who continues to have the most impact on the news, it's got to be him, doesn't it? I mean, anyone want to argue with that?
2020 or 2021?
This year, this 2021.
No, I would not have made Donald Trump the man of the year. I made my case for it being the people that came up with the vaccine. I understand your point, but I think that's a better point for why Kamala and Joe were it in 2020, because they weren't Donald Trump. I was getting some blowback from my listeners this week, Eric, about this a little bit. And they say, you know, what has Kamala Harris and Joe Biden done? Like, what they've done is not be Donald Trump. You know, that's what they've done. And by the way, let's not forget that while Donald Trump got the second most votes ever, Joe Biden got the most votes ever. So, you know, he earned that. If Joe Biden was running against somebody else, would he have gotten as many votes as he did? Hell no. Hell no. That was all about Donald Trump. Who's your person of the year, Austin?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. I was literally just thinking who it would be. Ugh.
I was glad that they made Simone Biles the athlete of the year. I mean, that seems to be thoughtful. Was there a greater athlete and was there a greater drama than the Simone Biles story? So, yeah, good on them.
Man, I have no idea. Who should it be? Are we thinking just America? Oh, man, I would need to think more, I think. What's Ken Bone doing?
I don't even know who Ken Bone is. Who's Ken Bone?
Remember Ken Bone? He's the guy in that red sweater during, he's from Belleville. And he got famous because he asked a town hall question during the debates he was like the one undecided guy between Clinton and Trump.
Oh, yes.
For athlete of the year, how do you vote against Otani on the Angels? The guy who
pitches. That's a great point.
He's a once in a lifetime athlete. Who's an incredible pitcher, an incredible batter. Not since Babe Ruth. His stats are even better than Babe Ruth.
Yeah, sure. And seems like a good guy too. But I mean, I'm sorry. Are you saying that he is better at his sport than Simone Biles is at hers?
I guess, you know, yeah. I mean, he might well be. I think he is a generational talent. Of course, she is too. But of course, she's most famous this year for not competing.
Who has better name recognition?
Well, Biles does. But see, this is why Time Magazine does this, by the way. So people like us will argue on our podcasts about it.
Yeah.
But we've fallen into their trap.
I don't know how that works anymore.
Keeps them relevant. You know, and John, I might actually sign on with your vaccine creators as people of the year, because that you're right. In terms of an impact on not just the U.S., but on the world. Absolutely, the vaccine.
And Simone Biles did compete. She did come back and win a medal, right? All right. Well, Austin, you haven't given us a name yet, unless you want to agree with me. You don't have to,
no,
by the way. You can.
I'll text you later when I think of it.
Okay. Well, that's because you're very thoughtful, and I'm a talk show host. All right. So that wraps it up then. That's Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, Eric Zorn from the Picayune Sentinel. By the way, if you want to subscribe to it, just email ericzorn@gmail.com. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ashley Byhun. And for one more podcast, Elif Garris, she is leaving Chicago and heading to California to pursue her music dreams. She's a singer-songwriter, and she has not only a unique look, but a unique sound and real drive and ambition. Those things will serve her well. Boy, I hope so. We'll have to ask Elif to drop in on the podcast before we get done here at the end of the year.
Absolutely. That would be great.
Yes, we owe her a lot for all the work she's done for us over the years. So let's do that.
We'll drop another podcast on you next week. Okay, boys.
Thanks.
Hey,
You guys are my men of the year.
Hey.
God, why didn't I think that? My man of the year is awesome.
My man of the year every year? The big man, Jesus Christ.
Okay, you win. You win.
I don't know about you, humans, but...
What are you saying? An athlete is better than God?
He didn't compete this year.
Oh, I didn't know that about it. Hey, look, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.